Welcome to Talking Energy, the UK Energy Research Centre podcast.
Hi, I'm Claire Spina. I'm Head of Decarbonising Transport at the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, which is part of UKRI Research and Innovation, where I also work on COP26. Today, I'm joined by the co-directors of UKIRC, the UK Energy Research Centre, Professor Gillian Annabel from the University of Leeds and Professor Christian Brand from the University of Oxford. And we're going to explore some of the challenges in hitting our key net zero target to cut emissions by 78% by 2035, specifically looking through the lens of decarbonising transport, where emissions from vehicles have stubbornly remained the same at about 27% of UK emissions. We'll cover implications from COP26 and the COVID scenario that's taking place on mobility. Then we'll consider the phase out of the internal combustion engine and links to active and avoided travel. In essence, we're going to have a quick canter through the world of decarbonising transport. And what better place to start than COP26? As you know, it's coming up in November 2021. And thinking about that, mobility and clean transport are one of the government's key themes for COP26 and somewhere we really need to move the dial and reduce emissions at pace. But what can realistically be expected to be achieved? Gillian, I wonder if you had any initial thoughts.
We do have a long way to go in transport, as you've said. So globally, something like 97% of all transport movements are still fueled by a fossil fuel of some form or another. So huge transition. Technology wise, yes, there's lots of potential. And we know this in the sense that that's where most policy and most investment lies. We're pushing on that really quite far and quite fast. So I'm sure we can talk more about that. I'm keen also to talk about what the potential is on the demand side. And I think when we think about travel, we think that it's inevitable that it's just going to grow and grow because apparently that's what's happened and that's what we have to accommodate. But in actual fact, in Western developed economies, quite consistently, when you look around over the past couple of decades, the average amount that people travel by car has actually plateaued, if not reduced. So although there's lots and lots of demand growth still to go in many developed economies, in Western developed economies, we really need to think of strategies that combine both demand reduction and certainly not strategies that think that it's just inevitably there to grow and grow with technology.
It's interesting. Surprisingly, the focus of COP26 doesn't really touch so much on aviation, shipping and rail, that modal shift of travel demand. It does tend to focus on clean transport and specifically thinking of EVs. Christian, I wonder if you had any thoughts around that.
You know, that's absolutely right. So the focus is very much on vans, buses, trucks, lorries and cars. Very little, if anything, on active travel. I didn't see any, at least on the website and some of the supporting documents, which are looking at sort of life cycle analysis of EVs versus, for example, fossil fuel vehicles. And EVs are usually the winner. But it's this focus on the technology side and this sort of optimistic view of technology to solve the day, which is a little bit worrying because in COP terms, it really is the next 10 years. And as you say, we have a 2035 target, let's say 14 years that are absolutely crucial. It's not the end goal of 2050. And this sort of transformation in the system versus electrification really only comes to fruition in 2050. Before, yeah, you see some benefits, but I think we could do a lot more, as Julian said.
So it's quite interesting what you're saying there, that a lot of it is linked to actually if we take away the technological solution being the key focus, which obviously I work for the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, that while I take things that are interdisciplinary, that's quite challenging for me to not think that technology is the solution. But you think that demand side is just as important in achieving that kind of future vision to reduce emissions?
Yes, I would say so. I think we've done some work recently here just for the UK, and that showed that if you try to avoid travel in the first place, so reducing the need to travel, shifting to the most sustainable modes of transport, and then it's a bit like a hierarchy, and you do those things first, and then you do focus on the efficiency bit, which is the improved side of transport. And that's basically electrifying transport, which gives you, in pure energy terms, sort of a factor of three in terms of efficiency. So an EV is roughly a factor of three more efficient in terms of turning energy into movement than the equivalent fossil fuel vehicle. So you do this last, but you start off with, the need to travel in the first place. And there is significant potential for that. About half of the emission savings in the UK could come from the demand side.
Goodness, that's actually huge. And I suppose if we consider the big news story in the run-up to COP26 has been COVID, which has changed many working patterns with an increase in working from home and international travel curtailed. Gillian, what would you say that the impact that the stay-at-home rules and lockdown have had on transport emissions?
There's lots of research that's been done on this, including our own here at the University of Leeds, where we've had a longitudinal study following quite a large set of people around situated in the UK over time. And whether it's our data, whether it's the national data on traffic, we can see, of course, that during COVID, during the lockdowns, there was significant reduction in traffic and emissions, including local air quality emissions. But that has largely bounced back. The point, however, is whilst that's the aggregate picture, the point is to really understand whether or not there have been some important changes in individual journey purposes, and therefore to think whether those things can be locked in. And certainly with respect to travel to work, so the commute, there has been a sizable shift, as we know, to working from home. It's a shift that was happening pre-COVID, but it's like sort of a decade has been of change has been condensed into a year. Now, the thing with that is that the commute is only about 20% of the travel that we do in terms of the distance. And it's only around 50% of workers that can work from home. And they're not going to carry on working from home 100% of the time. So when you follow all that through, it's still only a very minor part of the whole picture in terms of personal travel. But it's still worth thinking about how we can lock those savings in. And what that means is that where people are working from home, we need to try and encourage them to, when they do travel into the office, to not travel in by car. We need to encourage people to stay living in accessible places and not want to move out to more remote places. So that's about placemaking in particular. So it's not just as simple as just working from home is great. And of course, we also, at the business side end of it, there are other energy implications. So that we need a shrinkage in office space and the energy used in the offices at the same time. So it's quite complicated, but there is potential there.
I think it is right to say it's quite a complex landscape. Linked to that, I was wondering, are there any other benefits, those kind of benefit spillovers that have occurred during COVID? For instance, we all get deliveries now and we get them at a higher percentage. So we get our food delivered, our deliveries from our online shopping. Has that reduced overall emissions a bit, or is that really just a tiny percentage of the equation?
The deliveries is really interesting because, of course, you are replacing one form of travel, going, you know, individuals going to get their shopping with vans. And certainly when I do public engagement events, it's almost guaranteed going to be asked by somebody, what's the point of getting something delivered? It's just being delivered by a van. Uh-huh. And that's very true. Yeah. I think, again, the point here is about it happening at scale. And again, it's been accelerated. It was a trend that was happening. It's been pushed on. It's whether or not it can happen now at a scale and the business models will develop around that, which means that very efficient logistics chains are put into place. However, one of the things I would say is that the expectation that has grown and grown again pre-COVID, but during COVID, of next day delivery, want everything now, that's never going to allow for the most efficient logistics and supply chains. That's always going to have an environmental penalty because it can't be optimized in the same way. So there are, you know, there are bits that, that there are sort of expectations that have changed around this that possibly aren't quite for the better.
That's really interesting. I suppose moving on, thinking about the domestic agenda and the recently released DfT Transport Decarbonisation Plan, I was wondering if, Christian, you could tell us something about the plan and the key elements of the plan and how you think it will provide us with a direction to achieve net zero, when we also have to consider how complex the entire landscape is. If we don't design our cities in the right ways, then people won't have access to travel, and it really is quite that complex landscape, and I wonder if you could reflect on that.
Yeah, so the plan came out this year, probably delayed by about a year. And when it was first announced that there was a consultation around the plan, I think the wording was very encouraging in a sense, because they talked about this sort of reversal of the hierarchy, having sort of the sustainable modes at the top of the hierarchy and then maybe individual car travel at the bottom of it. But I don't think that made it into the actual final plan. I think it's a lot talking about electrification again, and how to support this, and quite detailed little sort of aspects of this in terms of charging infrastructure and supporting this and some investment around there and in that area. So I think on that side, they're making progress. It could still be a little bit better, but my worry is that they, by doing so, they're basically pushing the can a little bit down the road. In three aspects. One is the more difficult aspects of demand reduction were basically put into some more consultation where not even mentioned on air travel, for example. So the message was very much, let's keep doing what we've been doing over the last, whatever, various 3-4 decades. You can still fly to X, Y, and Z. You can still do all your car travel.
I can still go on my holiday.
Yeah, you just go on holiday.
Yeah,
but with some sort of future sustainable aviation fuels that don't really exist yet. Mm-hmm. So there's this sort of what we call sort of climate delay. It's pushing the can further down the line, and let's get COP out of the way and then see what happens. So I'm a little bit worried on this. On the electrification side, well, I mean, they have, you know, the main policy there is really this phasing out of fossil fuel cars, but it's really sort of 2035. Yeah, they say 2030, but, you know, there will be aspects of plug-in hybrid vehicles that are still allowed to be sold up to 2035. So in 2034, which is now, you know, 13 years away, you could still buy a fossil fuel car, which then will be used for the next 15 years. So come 2050, you still have a few of those around. I don't think that's very ambitious. It's quite shocking.
Yeah.
At the same time, they rely on industry and consumers to really take the lead there. Our government takes a little bit of a, you know, offhand role there.
You think we're in a position where the target of 2035, where we will achieve selling no new cars that are made and fueled by diesel and petrol, is that achievable?
I think so. It's not hugely ambitious if you think about it. I mean, these sort of production cycles of manufacturers, they are 5 to 10 years into the future, and they will have plenty of time there.
Do you think we have the infrastructure there in order to achieve, you know, in order to deliver that? Will everyone be able to charge their cars?
It's certainly plausible, but I think you have to, maybe you want to come in there.
I think the two things about whether it's possible or not. One, it's been made possible by the fact that they're allowing plug-in hybrid electrics still to be sold to 2035. So as Christian said, they are effectively fossil fuel cars. And we have to remember that certainly at the moment, they're driven 75% of the time on the fossil fuels. So they're really not, they're sort of fake electric vehicles. I think that's what I like to call them. So that's certainly going to oil the wheels, as it were, to the transition for the motor manufacturers. In terms of the charging infrastructure, I think actually it's really quite a long time to get the charging infrastructure out there in public spaces and workplaces. It's the residential areas that are the issue. And I think we're a little bit head in the sand about the really difficult sort of 20-30% of car owning homes that are the really difficult ones to put the charging infrastructure in. So I think we could get a long way there quite quickly, but it's that last bit of, and we're still talking, you know, around 10 million cars that are parked out there at the moment. If we keep the size of the fleet the same, which no one's unfortunately talking about any other thing, then, you know, there is, I think, a bit of a head in the sand around what we would really do with that last really non-trivial a number of vehicles out there.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. When you say the figure of 10 million, if we go with your 20% of residential are the issue, that's still 2 million cars. And that is quite startling as a figure. That's huge.
That's right, yeah. I mean, we have about... there's 30 million households out there, and there's about 20 million cars out there, I think, roughly, is the size of the fleet. And I think, you know, there's lots of different figures out there. One of the figures you hear is about the proportion of homes that have an off-street place to park, but that's not the same as the proportion of cars, because many households have more than one car but only one place to off-road to park them. So, you know, we've really got to be realistic about that huge number of cars that are out there, that it's looking quite difficult. And yeah, there'd be innovations. There's lamppost charging, there's pop-up things out of the pavement, but at the same time, we are, by doing all of that, we are giving more and more attention and road space and pavement space and infrastructure investment over to the car. And it is all still perpetuating that automobility system.
I think it's a really interesting point you make there about what do we actually want our streetscape to look like in the future? Do we want our pavements to be cluttered up with charging infrastructure, or do we want to enable people to use different modalities to travel and encourage those active travel methods to get around? No, that's really interesting. If we are to move to EV adoption, though, on a wider scale, should there be more incentives to adopt those new EV vehicles, and where would you put that intervention?
Yeah, I mean, I think always with sort of incentives and a policy around this, Norway is usually coming as the prime example, because they're really throwing everything at it. And with more of half of new sales now battery EVs, I think it's almost 70% this year, or up to, you know, sort of up to today. The vehicles on the road, they're actually on the road. And a colleague of mine just been to Norway, basically said, yeah, there's some EVs on the road. And they had one as a rental car, but essentially it's still dominated by fossil fuel cars. So it would take some time. And I think Gillian said earlier, it's about 15 years till the fleet is renewed if 100% of sales are now EV. So it will take some time. In terms of incentives that Norway has been throwing at this, I mean, it's basically from free car parking, free fuel, access restrictions for other cars other than EVs, a bit like the concession charge in London, where EVs are exempt from the charge. So this is one UK example, and I think the same is in Sweden and in Stockholm and other places. But Norway is really throwing everything at it. And they come also from a situation where the purchase tax on a car was so high that they basically just said, no, EVs don't have to pay that tax. So they're... they might lose a little bit of revenue, but then there's a rich country with, you know, where the most of the money comes actually from fossil fuel income, which is, you know, one of the interesting things with Norway, isn't it? That they can afford it in a sense. But if we did the same, I think there would be, it wouldn't be at the same scale in the UK, and it would take probably a little bit longer.
And moving on about this, Gillian, the government has set these kind of standards for phasing out of ICE vehicle, the internal combustion engine vehicles. And how has the market responded, and what kind of turnover are we actually seeing in the fleet moving that change to EVs?
Depending on which way you look at it, some people think we're you know, further ahead than we said we'd be, and some people like me say that we're not as far. If you look back to policy documents, you know, various iterations of carbon reduction plans and so on over the last couple of decades, you know, the EVs the big takeoff was just around the corner, and it kind of still is, really. I think, yes, it's accelerating, but we have to remember that that is the combination of pure battery electric vehicles and what I call these fake electric vehicles. So when you just take the figures for battery electric vehicles, pure EVs, we're still only at about 3-4% of the market, the new car market. At the same time, you have a much faster expansion of the proportion of the car market that is purely fossil fueled, very large cars. So they're expanding at a greater rate. And as Christian said, for every year that we carry on selling those, they're going to be with us for the next 15 years. So what we could do to reduce emissions much more quickly than push on EVs is actually reduce the sale of the larger vehicles, because the cumulative savings over the next decade, if we were to do that, would be greater, it seems, than our ability to accelerate the uptake of electric vehicles. But obviously, that's all around business models of the car manufacturers, public acceptability. You know, it's not a technology issue, it's a political issue.
Goodness. That is actually, you're right, it's quite challenging. If you look at the size of certain vehicles that have been, you know, souped up, so I'm thinking of the Fiat 500 and the Mini, yeah. The new iterations are far bigger than the original versions.
And actually, one of the issues is that people's tastes for larger cars has grown across the board. So they also expect the electric variants of their vehicles to be large, which you can say, well, why not if it's going to be electric powered? But of course, this is still energy we've got to find a source for, and electricity we have to generate. And the more pressure we put on the electricity system, the more we've got to fund and the infrastructure we've got to have, et cetera, et cetera. So it all matters, especially matters when we still haven't got a fully green electricity system, but it matters in terms of just, you know, we can't think that we can just use as much energy as we like, so long as it's green.
I think that's a really interesting point. I also wanted to touch on the secondhand market for EVs. Are we giving the incentives to the right people, Christian? It seems to, in my opinion, it seems that the spillover, the kind of initial purchaser is the person who gets the discounted benefits, whereas the secondhand market, I think they don't seem to get quite the benefit from those incentives.
Yeah, the secondhand market is quite fascinating. I mean, last year it went completely bonkers, really, because people were sort of were told not to use public transport anymore, and some people basically bought a second or a third car, which was sort of older, maybe diesel or petrol, and used that instead. And I think at one point, even the secondhand car price was higher than new cars. So it went completely bonkers in that sense. Do we provide the right incentives? I don't know. I can't really say. I mean, in a sense, it's the upfront cost is still one of the main issues here. But it's also then your future savings. And there, of course, electric vehicles, if they are on the market, then that should be basically put to consumers.
So moving on to considering active travel then, Christian. Recently, there's been an increase in calls for policies to support active travel. And we all know that increased a lot during lockdowns. People were cycling more, people were walking more. But what can be done to ensure that these gains are not entirely lost?
But active travel, I mean, let's talk about sort of walking, cycling, but also e-biking and some of the more new e-micromobility forms like e-scooters and all sorts of other stuff. I mean, there's some quite fascinating things happening on mainland Europe, for example, or in Australia. But they have significant carbon emissions benefits, largely by replacing motorized travel. So cyclists and walkers are generally having lower daily carbon footprints. That it's not necessary... you cannot necessarily conclude then that as a whole country you have a lower carbon footprint if there's high cycling rates. Like look at Holland or the Netherlands, they pretty much travel as much as we do in terms of car travel. But you'd be sort of comparing apples and oranges a little bit. I mean, the Netherlands have slightly different contexts and better accessibility to the south of France, so more urbanization. So I think they do travel more for leisure. But the price to be had on active travel, I would say, is between sort of 5% and 50% of car emissions. And the 50% is really, if you look at what's our capability, physical capability as people to walk, to cycle a certain distance that we do right now in terms of going to work or shopping or leisure trips. And the 5% is probably the lower end, which is much more realistic, looking at people's actual travel patterns, the availability in rural areas to do anything like cycling where it's not safe enough. So, and safety, I guess, is the key issue there. So the one message from me would be to increase safety, particularly for women and vulnerable users.
Yeah, I think I would echo that. I'm far too scared to cycle on a road. So I use the cycle paths, which are plentiful in my town, but I am far too scared to go on a road. And I don't think I'll ever get over that fear. And it's perhaps an unjustified fear, but the speed of cars next to me on a bike scares me.
Yeah.
And it is a barrier to me using that as a method to get to work. Gillian, I wonder if you wanted to touch on the kind of health benefits, those kind of unintended benefits that actually also come from active travel, you know, culture and air pollution reductions.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think, you know, it's not rocket science, is it, to understand that obviously more physical forms of travel bring health benefits. But really, it's still a matter of if those forms of active travel are not replacing other forms of physical activity, or if they must also be abstracting from car use for it to give a net benefit as society. One of the things I would say is that we again, thinking about COVID, and we look back to last year, and we saw certainly from the data that we have, it was walking that was the real winner from COVID. Mm. And walking is a... You know, it's something that, apart from for some people, it's a universal mode. It's a mode of travel that's often involved in most journeys, you know, to and from the other end of the bus stop, or, you know, even to and from the car or whatever. And yet in policy, we talk about active travel, but we jump straight to talking about cycling. And also we don't collect the data on walking very well. So the official statistics for walking increases in COVID are that walking was down, because most of the counters for walking were around the sort of business districts or retail areas, whereas
really?
Walking in neighbourhoods and locally has been way up. And this is just an example of how, you know, poor data collection. You know, if we don't see it, we don't measure it, we don't think it's important, and we don't apply the same attention to it and investment to it. And it's, you know, it's really one of the most modes with the most potential, I would say, because, as I say, and with micromobility and cycling, it's not necessarily even about thinking about whole journeys by these modes. It's about improving the links to the public transport services, which really make up a transport and mobility system that works well, rather than thinking about everything, you know, in terms of, you know, individual discrete journeys.
I think it's fascinating what you say there. It really resonates with me that we're not perhaps doing our data collection in the most effective way to actually truly represent what's happening on the ground. Yeah. And perhaps if we had those different ways of collecting the data, then we would come away with different statistics and different incentives because of that. That's really
exactly.
Fascinating. Excellent. I wonder, Christian, if you wanted to touch on kind of the international car ownership market, thinking of the international landscape with families growing economies and having their car ownership within their means across the world, international car sales will rocket as people want to upgrade their kind of skills and their access to travel. So I suppose, what learning can the UK share to address this issue?
I mean, that's a big question. But I suppose if you look at, say, the global south, and with that I mean the sort of low and medium income countries, I mean, it's really expected that in those countries, as you say, the car ownership will increase a lot. And because if you look at the markets down there, it's essentially a secondhand car market. So things are being imported rather than produced in the country or sold as new. And if you look at the age profile, for example, in Kenya, I mean, most cars are older than 3 or 4 years. There's hardly any new ones. So you basically import them after being sold maybe from the fleet market or the company car market in other countries. That makes it very difficult. And the price of those secondhand cars is about a tenth of a new electric vehicle. So that leaves electric vehicles really for people in power, people with the money, the politicians showing it off probably at COP or something. I don't know. It's a little bit of a cynical view there. But that's what we found in some of our research. But at the same time, there is, especially if you look at not cars now, but electric two-wheelers and three-wheelers, who really are the big growth market in some sub-Saharan African countries, for example, where probably as the UK, we can't actually tell them what to do. They will tell us what, you know, how to do this, and integrate that with an ICT market that's also a little bit more advanced than what we have here in terms of mobile phone coverage and everything, and then link that to off-grid electricity production, you know, sort of mini grids that are run on with solar PV.
I saw a fascinating innovation the other day, which was a flat-packed solar-powered electric vehicle that was made in Warwick and then being shipped out to the developing world. And I think those kind of key innovations are maybe one way to help us tackle the kind of skilling up of that area, the take-up of that area. Moving on, and just to help us draw our conversation together, what would both of your COP asks be? What outcomes are you really looking for out of the COP process?
I think whether it's aviation or whether it's passenger travel, I think we have to, as with many other parts of the COP process, we have to find a way of accepting that those who do more of the stuff have to pay more in some way, shape or form. And when it comes to aviation, globally, there's a huge inequality in terms of the sort of per capita flights taken. And in actual fact, the UK, the Brits, have the highest average number of flights per annum of any country in the world.
Really? Oh, my word.
Now, we are an island, a fairly wealthy island surrounded by water, and we like to get off of our island. So there's a, you know, there's a geographical element to that, you know. But nevertheless, there is that inequality globally. But then when you zoom into a country such as the UK again, you've got staying with flying. You've got a statistic, which is that only 15% of the population account for 75% of the flights. So it's not some great sort of democratic activity because we've now got cheap flights. It's still an exclusive activity. So again, we have, you know, there are different issues perhaps when you look at the business travel element and the freight travel element versus the passenger. But talking about passenger travel, it is the wealthy who fly the most. And it is seemingly accepted that's okay. And the more they want to fly, that's fine. It's the principle around some kind of frequent flyer tax, or even if it's a carbon tax that really bites, that says, you know, that effectively means the more you do it, the more you pay. And it's that kind of principle that's directed at travel markets that I'd like to see.
Kristen, what would your takeaway be? What would your ideal outcome?
For me, the main ask is that policymakers really address transport holistically, because, you know, we've talked about this focus on the silver bullet, which doesn't really exist, which is electrification. So for surface transport, coming back down to earth, is that really means more walking, more cycling, more zero emission public transport, more e-biking, e-scooters. And we need to make sure those vehicles are shared as much as possible, not individual. and electric, and they're the sort of subordinate to other healthier forms of transport.
Brilliant. As I think you can see from this discussion today, there are so many areas that require careful consideration to ensure that interdisciplinary research and innovations develop the correct suite of technological and, in tandem with social science, those key behavioural and economic issues, as well as environmental elements embedded within the research outcomes. So thanks to Gillian and Christian for such an interesting discussion, and to you, Kirk, for its pioneering work in this space.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about UKIRC, you can visit our website at www.ukerc.ac.uk.